I'd like to begin today telling you a little story. There was a man who worked in the produce section of a grocery store, and he was asked by a lady if he could buy a half a head of lettuce. Half a head, he said, are you serious? God grows these things whole, and that's how we sell them. And she replied, you mean after all the years I've shopped here, you won't sell me half a head of lettuce? He says, look, if it means that much to you, I'll go ask the manager. So he heads up to the front of the store, and he says to the manager when he finds him, you won't believe this, but there's this lame-brained idiot of a lady back there who wants to know if she can buy half a head of lettuce. And the manager is, you know, quickly gesturing, and the man turns around and he sees the lady followed him up to the front of the store. And so he then quickly says, and this nice lady wants to buy the other half. Later in the day, the manager corners the young man, and he says, that's the finest example of thinking on your feet that I've ever seen. Where did you learn that? He says, well, I grew up in Grand Rapids, and if you know anything about Grand Rapids, it's known for its hockey teams and its ugly women. The manager's face turns all red, and he says, my wife is from Grand Rapids. And the young man says, and what hockey team did she play for? Our tongue can get us in all kinds of trouble at times, can't it? I'm sure that probably every person here can relate an embarrassing story, maybe not like this young man, but you've said the wrong thing at the wrong time to the wrong person, wish you could just pull all those words back in, but it's too late. Part of that is because our tongue has such great power. The power in saying the wrong thing, but also the power of saying the right thing. My former career in the graphic arts industry, I probably would have never gone that route with my life if my mother had not encouraged me. I also had an art teacher in high school that was very supportive. My mom part-time taught music, piano primarily, and all my four brothers learned something, trumpet or violin or clarinet, saxophone, all kinds of different things. Mom tried to work with me I don't know how many years. And I finally found a cartoon that I had framed for her with a little boy saying to his music teacher, trying to teach him piano, if God had wanted me to play piano, he would have given me 88 fingers. So she paid for art lessons, and that's where I went from there. But encouraging words on a daily basis can be very powerful, can't they? Just like negative words can be very powerful. We respond to what we hear, and we begin to believe these things. But on a positive level, a card sent to someone struggling, maybe just sitting and listening, picking up the phone and calling someone just to let them know you're thinking of them. So today we're going to consider the power of the tongue. We're going to use James 3 as our anchor as we go through this. So let's turn there. If you have a ribbon or some sort of card you can put in that spot, we'll use this chapter as a reference, but we'll turn to some other things along the way. But James makes an interesting statement here. He acknowledges, as we heard in the sermonette, about sin and some of its pervasiveness, but he frames it this way, James 3, verse 2, for we all stumble in many things. If anyone does not stumble in word, he is a perfect man, able to bridle the whole body. We know he's talking about words because he says that. If one does not stumble in word, we can say the wrong thing. There can be times when we should say something and we don't say anything, and it can be just as bad. But what James is revealing here is a vital key to being in God's kingdom. He frames it in the context of we all stumble in many things. So how do we stumble? It's not just in words, but words express ourselves, our heart. We'll come to that in a moment. But we can have hasty words. We can have short words with people. We don't have the patience. They come to us when we're not wanting to deal with something. We can exalt ourselves. We can put others down. Gossip, innuendo, insinuation, all of these things. We see this all around us on a regular basis. So again, hold your place here. Let's go to Mark chapter 7 next, because Christ frames this to make sure, as we discuss this topic here today, that we're not just talking about words. We're talking about why our tongue can have such power. So in Mark 7, In verse 20, he has this to say: what comes out of a man defiles a man. Now, the Jews had all sorts of regulations: how to wash cups, what foods you could eat in certain ways, how to wash your hands, you know, all these kind of things. They were focused on the physicality of things. And in some cases, there is value. I mean, hygiene is important. But they were missing a bigger point here, and he's reminding us of this here. He says, what comes out of a man is what defiles a man. Verse 21, from within, out of the heart of men, proceed evil thoughts. Our words are simply expressions of what we're thinking. That's why we need to consider it. Sometimes in talking with people, as I've mentioned when I gave this sermon this morning, a big part of my job is simply listening to people. My responsibility as a pastor. Sometimes people know what they need to do, but they just need to hear themselves say it out loud. They just need to be reminded. Sometimes they don't know what they need to do, but hearing it out loud reminds them what they need to do. But here's Christ's list of these things, these evil thoughts: adulteries, fornications, murders, thefts, covetousness, wickedness, deceit, lewdness, an evil eye, meaning an eye that is attracted to evil, blasphemy, pride, foolishness. And notice this, all these things come from within and defile a man. So what we think about is very important. Because that's what gives our tongue power. It can be for wrong things or it can be for right things. Remember what we just read in James 3 just a moment ago. If anyone does not stumble in word, he is a perfect man. Maybe James had Christ in mind. They were half brothers. They grew up in the same household. Maybe James didn't think much about these things as he heard Christ talk in public, in private, at home. Maybe he remembered them later. Maybe God just simply inspired him to record what he did in James 3. But they grew up in the same house, and I have to wonder if he didn't pay attention to some of this, even if it's in hindsight. So let's go back to James, but this time chapter 1. James 1 and verse 4, James says, "But let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing." Now again, we're talking about the tongue. What does this verse have to do with that? He gets to this later, doesn't he? But keep in mind what we just read in Mark 7. We're talking really about what comes out of our heart. And in order to become perfect, as it says here, we have to have patience. But also in that patience, to realize we need to pay attention to what we're thinking about. The old adage is, what you think, you end up doing. What you end up doing, you become. This is why this is all so important. This perfect work is our calling, isn't it? It's not a matter of never, ever making a mistake. We're human. What it is about the process and being engaged in paying attention to change to become like God. So, James 1, verse 18. Of his own will, speaking of God, he brought us forth by the word of truth, that we might be a kind of first fruits of his creation. That is, that you and I are here in part because God has called us to be this group that is an example that the world will follow later. The question is, will we be a good example or a bad example? But he brings us forth to be a first fruit. That means a change. Verse 26, if anyone among you thinks he is religious and does not bridle his tongue, see, James is coming back to this throughout this whole book. If we want to be perfect, we could add, going back to verse 4, if anyone wants to be perfect and doesn't bridle his tongue but deceives his own heart, this one's religion is useless. We can say all we want. We can quote all we want from God's word. But if we're not living it in deed and action, then it's useless. As James says, we might as well not do it. Again, hold a marker or something here in James. Let's go back to Psalm 34. Psalm 34 and verse 11. Come, you children, and listen to me, and I will teach you of the fear of the eternal. Who is the man who desires life? This is an interesting place to pause, because we've gotten to a place as a culture where the answer to this is not obvious. We have a culture of death around us, a glorification of violence. We see it in the news and things that are happening where people don't see that violence as a problem. We see it even in sometimes a not-so-kidding way of people saying, I just don't see any value in living. But let's proceed here. Who is the man who desires life? This is a question, really. Do you want long life? Do you love having many days? Do you want to live a long life that you may see good? If that's what you want, the answer is verse 13, how to do that. Keep your tongue from evil and your lips from speaking deceit. And then verse 14, depart from evil and do good, seek peace and pursue it. The way we speak can be something that we don't give much thought to. And what we're covering here today is simply a reminder to pay attention to it. I've encountered people that have a very biting sense of humor, and it hurts people. They think they're being funny. But until someone points it out, they don't know. Siblings are real good at this. You know the soft spots, don't you? And it's not even that you have to say something harsh, but you know certain things that, to use the term, will trigger them. It's no different. The right use of our tongue is incredibly important. Even Isaiah understood this. If you want to write in your notes, Isaiah 6, first seven verses of that chapter, God is calling Isaiah as a prophet to go speak his message to the nation. And Isaiah said to God, I am a man of unclean lips. Now, he just didn't mean that figuratively. I believe what he was talking about is what we're covering today. Isaiah looked at himself and said, why are you using me? Because he knew, not that he was an evil man, but he saw his flaws inside. He knew who he was. But God then figuratively cleanses him. Do you remember? He takes that coal, touches his lips, and says that now he doesn't have unclean lips. To go forward, let's go back to James 3. It's easy to consider this topic and talk about all the things we shouldn't do, shouldn't say, shouldn't think. But perhaps it's better to look at this in a more positive vein. What James is saying essentially here is that if we can control our tongue, we can control the rest of our carnal nature. That can sound overly simplistic, but he uses some examples here that we're going to look at. So James 3 and verse 3. Again, he's talking about bridling the whole body, so then he transitions in verse 3 to talking about bits in horses' mouth. He says, we put bits in horses' mouths that they may obey us, and we turn their whole body. Now, I didn't look up, but I just had a thought in my mind. You know, how much does an average horse weigh? I don't know. 800 pounds? I don't know. More? 1,000? 1,500? Ton and a half. That's a lot of weight, isn't it? For a short time when I was a young man, young boy, we had some horses. They were actually my dad's cousins, but he was at a point in his life where he couldn't take care of them for a time, so we went up to his farm and we took care of them. One was a quarter horse. That horse looked huge to me. I was probably 13 years old or so. The Appaloosa was the one with the attitude. And one day, the next younger brother from me was simply brushing the horse, and this is the way the horse was, decided, just for whatever reason, it picked up its rear foot and just put it right down on Jeff's foot, top of his foot, and just rested. You know, you could just see the hip shift. all that weight on my brother's foot. But when you put a bit in their mouth, they might still have an attitude, but you could control them. This is what James is talking about. We're no different. He's drawing this analogy out. We turn their whole body. Verse 4, look at ships as well. Although they are so large and driven by fierce winds, they are turned by a very small rudder wherever the pilot desires. Have you ever seen the rudders even on the modern ocean tankers? They're not that big. A little thing that can control such mass. James is saying that's what our tongue is like here. Wherever the pilot desires. So we're reading here examples of something small controlling something really large. And in doing this, he's giving us an important tip. These things have power, don't they? A horse has great strength. A ship can carry enormous loads. And yet, through those relatively small things, a bridle, a rudder, you can control and direct where those things go. And so essentially what James is saying is control the tongue and you control everything else in your life. Notice verse 5, even so the tongue is a little member and boasts great things, and see how great a forest a little fire kindles. It doesn't take much to start a big fire, does it? If the conditions are right, a few years ago out in California, they had those major fires up in the central area of California. They determined after some investigation that what caused those fires was a transformer shorted out. Now, the way the laws are written in California, you can sue the power company for any damages, whether it's their fault or not. But what the power company found out is that the reason the transformer shorted was somebody decided they were going to use it for target practice. All those fires, all those homes destroyed, all that property damaged, it all started with a few sparks from that transformer. This is part of what James is talking about here. Verse 6, this tongue is like fire, he says, a world of iniquity. The tongue is so set among our members that it defiles the whole body and sets on fire the course of nature. And it is set on fire by hell. And there's a lot in this verse that we're going to work out here. But again, that small spark that can start such a big fire, a small, innocuous, we think, thing we say that can do great harm. We use small fires all the time that we don't think about. But they still are very effective, aren't they? Spark plugs in our car, your car wouldn't move if it didn't have that little spark to make that fire inside that engine, that combustion, pilot lights on furnace and things of this nature, stoves. But let's consider this a little deeper here. How do we become perfect, as Scripture says? We've touched on this a little bit. We consider doctrinal understanding, certainly, don't we? It's important to know what it is that God expects of us, what He stands for. So we consider things like the Sabbath and the Holy Day and other instructions that He gives us. And all of that is necessary. We consider overcoming sin because we have to change this nature, our body, our minds, to yield to what He is instructing us in. We're told to take on the mind of Christ. All of those things are necessary. But how do we control our life in order to do all of those things? What James is making the case for here is that the tongue is the key factor in controlling our actions in order to accomplish all the rest of that. Why is that? It might sound too simple, might sound too bold, but I don't believe that it's either of those things, because the tongue is the key to what we think, as we read in Mark 7. We say what's in our heart. You can see what's in people's hearts just by the language they use. You can see what's in their heart by what they talk about with that language. Remember chapter 1, verse 26 we read earlier. If anyone among you thinks he is religious and does not bridle his tongue, he deceives himself. Let's, again, hold your place here, but let's go back to Matthew chapter 12. Christ makes this statement again about it's not the tongue, that's simply the tool. It's really what's in our heart. Matthew 12 and verse 34. You brood of vipers, how can you, being evil, speak good things? The interesting thing about Christ is that he never belittled anyone. When he corrected individuals, it was because they were misusing their authority, and especially when they were misrepresenting what God expected of mankind. So he calls them out on this here and reminds them they're hypocritical. How can you, being evil, speak good things? For out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. And they made his case, didn't they? Did they kill Jesus Christ? Not with their hands. They made sure that they were clean, because in their mind, if I don't do the action, then I am righteous. But who stirred up the mobs? Who called out the Roman authorities? Who paid Judas the money? Who did all that took place to set in motion his ultimate crucifixion? In my mind, they knew what they had done, because when Judas came back to them with money, what did they call it? They called it blood money. They knew what they had done. And so Christ was not overreaching here. They knew it. They knew they were evil. They still tried to justify themselves. But this is the point we're making here, isn't it? Out of the heart. That's why it's so important to consider these things, what we're thinking. So going back to James 3, verse 6, let's look at this verse a little bit more here. James 3, verse 6 says, the tongue is a fire. We talked about that. A world of iniquity. That word iniquity literally means unrighteousness. So to read it that way, the tongue is a fire, a world of unrighteousness. Because that's carnal nature unchecked, isn't it? This is where you and I stand before God calls us. This is what we have to walk through with his help when we come to repentance and baptism, to acknowledge that what we are naturally is not what can be in his family. And then he works with us to change those things. But look at the hasty words, the exalting of self, putting down others, distorting truth in the world around us. And the caution is always in our calling to not let that come into the church. Because it's easy, isn't it? When you're surrounded by people who swear all the time, you start thinking about that, don't you? When you are around people that put others down all the time, it's hard not to embrace that at some point. This is why it's important to not only have the right friends, but to guard what goes into our heart. How much of the world do we allow to live in us? It's a question we need to ask ourselves all the time, because it's easy to get wrapped up in the emotion of the world, isn't it? And this world is not getting any less emotional. It's not operating with logic and reason and purpose and understanding. It's just careening from one crisis to the next. And we need to make sure that we're not doing that. God calls us to come out of this world. So let's continue here in verse 6. The next thought he says is that the tongue is so set among our members that it defiles the whole body. This is the influence that the tongue figuratively has. That's why bridling the tongue is so important. That the reason James says that other religious acts are useless if we don't check our tongue. He goes on to say then, and sets on fire the course of nature. And that expression is very interesting because it's hard to translate. Most translations will do a variation of what's in the New King James here that I'm reading. But the word there, course of nature, has the implication of something in a cycle. So some will translate it as a wheel of nature, but it's a cycle. The power of the tongue and the continuance that it has. What do we repeat with our tongue? if we're not careful, he concludes in this verse by saying, and it sets on fire by hell. The word hell there is the word Gehenna. Christ used that valley outside of the east of Jerusalem, I think it is, where basically it was a trash dump, and as they would burn things, because of the volume, it would sort of smolder. It was a constant smoke. But he used that as an analogy of the second death. James heard this, I'm sure, from Christ, and so he's in some ways drawing on that, that if we're not careful, the tongue, unchecked, in expressing those various satanic attitudes, unresolved, unfixed, unchanged, will lead to the second death. This is how critical it is. So let's continue in verse 7. For every kind of beast and bird of reptile and creature of the sea is tamed and has been tamed by mankind, meaning we rule over those things, don't we? But no man can tame the tongue. It is an unruly evil, full of deadly poison. We can't change someone else, so the instruction here is to change ourselves, to focus on that. Verse 9, with it we bless our God and Father, and then with it we curse men who have been made in the similitude of God. Out of the same mouth proceeds blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not to be so. And this is a reminder that what we read in Scripture is always first and foremost directed at us. It's easy to condemn the world, but they don't have God's Spirit, do they? They don't understand His plan, His purpose. Satan certainly is stirring them up. So he asks a somewhat rhetorical question here in verse 11. Does a spring send forth both fresh and bitter water from the same opening? No. No, it doesn't, because then he says, using a different analogy, similar, verse 12, can a fig tree, my brethren, bear olives, or a grapevine bear figs? Thus, no spring yields both salt water and fresh. You can't have it both ways. What's that called in psychological terms? Is that cognitive dissonance? You have one belief in your mind, but you're acting differently, and it creates this tension that's actually very unhealthy in the body, in the mind. To be double-minded, he even talks about that earlier in the book. A man is unstable when he's that way. So the choice is ours, isn't it? We're known by what and why and how we say things. So to continue in verse 13, who is wise and understanding? He's not transitioned thoughts here. He's still talking about this matter of how we speak and what's in our heart. Who is a wise and understanding person among you? Let him show by good conduct that his works are done in meekness and wisdom. And again, what directs our conduct? What we think. And a big part of our conduct is how we speak to one another. Verse 14, but if you have bitter envy and self-seeking in your hearts, do not boast and lie against the truth. This wisdom does not descend from above. I would put wisdom there in quotes. This wisdom, because it's not wisdom. But the world can think it's wise in the way that it behaves and treats each one another. Again, do we fall into that trap? Verse 16, for where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing are there. But the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. We're talking about our words. We could easily substitute our speech that is from above, and it would be just as applicable. Verse 18, now the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. We're called to be peacemakers, aren't we? And in Ephesians 4:29, we're told to let no corrupt words proceed from our mouth. That's a tall challenge, isn't it? The problem is we can't just not do something. we have to substitute it with something better. It's the way we're wired. So what are some practical things we can do to practice how we control our tongue? Well, one is to take the time to think about what the person is saying before responding. From last week, that's life lesson number 20. But to consider, sometimes we get ourselves in trouble because we cut somebody off before they even finish their thought. Even if we are right, how does that make the person feel? You do that enough, they won't offer their thoughts. We also need to consider where the other person is coming from. Sometimes those hurtful words we receive are not because we've done something wrong necessarily. Maybe they've had a no good, terrible, rotten week. Right? And they just, without checking themselves, they speak out of anger or hurt. Are we big enough to take that? In James 1, verse 5, we're told to pray for wisdom. That's just as valid for our words. And I will share with you, I do that all the time with dealing with God's people. I ask God to give me his wisdom, especially in counseling situations, to at the very least not make it worse than it is because of what I say. We can also ask ourselves before we say things to people, will our words build or will our words hurt? It seems like a simple thing, but to sort of make it pass the muster before we let it out of our mouth. Because we can't reel it back in, can we? As much as we apologize, it won't change the fact that it's out there. Let's go to Psalm 141 next. David writes something very interesting here, especially in light of my comment about checking our words before we say them out loud. Psalm 141 and verse 3. Set a guard, O Eternal, over my mouth. Keep watch over the door of my lips. Now, I'm not looking for a show of hands, but how many have prayed this? How many have asked God to do this in their lives? This is something we should keep in mind. Because we're asking God to change us. And if he's setting this guard over our heart, our mouth, actually, he's guarding our heart, isn't it? What we think internally gets expressed. So we have to change what we think internally first. Then we also need to practice some other things. Before I get to some of those verses, let's continue a list of some practical things to do. One is to catch people doing good. What does that mean in terms of the tongue? That we validate them when they do something nice. This is not only an excellent way to encourage people, but it actually primes them to do more of the same. We respond to what people think of us. If people think bad things of us, we'll respond to that. If they think good things of us, we will respond to that as well. So which do we want? Also then, don't overlook opportunities to give a pat on the back. God does this all the time. I think of the example of Elijah. You know, it's to me somewhat of a humorous example. But you remember Mount Carmel, the contest between him and the priests of Baal, and the whole theater that went on with that. And you would think at the end of the day that Elijah would just be brimming with confidence to have seen everything that God did, all the prayer that he answered. But Jezebel gets in Elijah's mind. Because you did all these things, I'm going to kill you. So what does Elijah do? He ran. He didn't just run. He ran with conviction. And if you add up the miles, it was over 100 miles that he ran south. He was trying to get as far away from her as he could. And he gets exhausted. Imagine that. And what does God do? He sends an angel to feed him. Okay, wake up. You need some food and water. Then you can go back to sleep. Does it again. And the third time he asks him, why are you here? I mean, doesn't God know? He knew. He's leading up to something. Then Elijah unloads on him. This is listening. God listened to him. Well, I'm the only one left. They've killed all the priests. Blah, blah, you know, boo-hoo-hoo. My life is horrible, which I understand. We get overwhelmed, don't we? We do the same thing before God all the time. And so then he encouraging. How does he encourage Elijah? You're not the only one. There are 7,000 left. And I need you to go do this. That may not sound like much encouragement, but he gave him a purpose. He still had work to do. He was still showing him that he wasn't the only one. He wasn't alone. We have the example in Matthew 25, the end of that chapter, is the parable of the talents. And you remember what the master did. He was going away, and he had three servants. He gave five talents to one, two to one, and one to the other. And he wanted them to do something with it. And when he came back, the five doubled it. That's a great return on your investment, isn't it? I wish for every dollar I put in the stock market, I'd get at least a dollar back. Doesn't always happen, does it? You remember what Christ, the master, said to him? Well done. Didn't qualify it. Five? Are you serious? I should have gotten a 200% response. No, well done. And then the two comes, and what did he do? He had, what, two, right? He doubled, but he's still way behind the one that had five. Christ said, well, you did okay, but I wish you'd caught up with the other guy. No, he says the same thing, doesn't he? Well done. I think God does this for us more than we pay attention to at times. But let's look at some Proverbs next. Proverbs 12. It's important to use our words properly, wisely, to think about what we're saying before we say it. Proverbs 12 and verse 18, we'll start here. We're going to go through several verses here in Proverbs. Proverbs 12, 18 says, there is one who speaks like the piercings of a sword. Have you ever been cut by words? I suspect everyone here has. But notice he says the corollary or the companion to this, but the tongue of the wise promotes health, lifts up, edifies, supports, encourages. The wise do this. Chapter 15, verse 1. A soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. There is something in our human nature. When we get into an argument with someone, we think the person that can yell the loudest is going to win. But it never works that way, does it? Both go away angry, hurt, probably stirred up more than before that wound up. It seems counterintuitive that the way to address harsh words is a soft answer. At the very least, I would encourage you to do this because it messes with their minds. If someone's screaming at you and you speak in a soft voice, they can't scream at you and hear you at the same time. It helps to de-escalate, even if they don't agree. Verse 2, the tongue of the wise uses knowledge rightly, but the mouth of fools pours forth foolishness. Knowledge can be used wrong as well as right, which means the words we use in expressing that knowledge can be right or wrong. We need to think about how we use our words and the knowledge that God gives us. Verse 4, a wholesome tongue is a tree of life, but perverseness in it breaks the spirit. This is as true for those who receive these words as those who give them. Because we read earlier what Christ said, as a man thinks in his heart, and if you're constantly angry, constantly bitter, constantly thinking about using these wrong ways of communicating, it actually has negative health consequences. Chapter 16, verse 24. Pleasant words are like a honeycomb, sweetness to the soul and health to the bones. Pure, unrefined deliciousness to be edified by. Have you ever had someone pay you a compliment out of the blue? Maybe it was something you were engaged in the moment. You were so immersed in whatever it was, you weren't thinking about anyone else. It was benefiting other people, but you were just doing it. And someone paused long enough to stop and tell you they appreciated what you were doing. That's this verse. Chapter 18, verse 21. Death and life are in the power of the tongue. If you tell a child constantly, you're ugly, you're stupid, you're worthless, what do they grow up believing? That they're ugly, stupid, worthless. But turn that around. That's death. What about life? You're valued, you're smart, I appreciate what you do. They rise to that as much as they rise to the other. So there's death and life in the power of the tongue. And those who love it, meaning life, will eat of its fruit. Lastly, here in this section, Proverbs 25, verse 11. You probably know this verse well without being able to quote it, perhaps, but it says, "A word fitly spoken is like apples of gold in settings of silver." Something precious and beautiful and valued. A word fitly spoken. Don't ever delay in giving someone a compliment, thanking them, praising them. Because too often people think that they can generate effort, outcome, if they berate you. Think of an employer that you may have had that operated that way. I had a boss like that once. It took me a while to figure it out, but I finally realized that whenever he was going out of town, the way he thought he would motivate everybody in his absence was he would literally go around to every department in the company, and he would start chewing them out for things they weren't doing right. And then he would go out of town, thinking that they're going to fix all these things while he was gone. You know what happened. Nothing got done while he was gone because they were so angry at everything that he'd come and chewed them out that by the time he got back, they were finally settled down and ready to do things. So it was actually the opposite of what he wanted. And the sad thing is that there are more and more studies done that show that employees don't leave companies. They leave bosses. And it's usually because how they're treated and mostly how they're talked to. The converse is true as well. Somebody will stay with a company that they don't get the pay necessarily they're looking for. They may not have the benefit package that they might desire, but they get treated well. Let's go to Hebrews 3 next. While you're turning there, I'm going to ask you a question here. Do you know who Judas Barsabbas was? Very well-known person in Scripture, but that's not the name we normally know him by. Just not looking to embarrass anybody, but does anybody know who Judas Barsabbas was? He's Barnabas. Barnabas was not his given name. Judas Barsabbas was his given name. The name Barnabas, depending on the translation, depending on the concordance, either means consolation or encouragement. Barnabas, evidently, was such a person to constantly give encouragement, constantly give support to be there, that instead of the apostles calling him Judas Barsabbas, they decided they would just call him what he is, Barnabas. Hebrews 3 and verse 13, "But exhort one another daily," not every so often, mark it on your calendar and make sure at least once a year, daily, he says, "exhort one another daily while it is called today. Do it while we have time. Lest any of you be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin." Nobody cares. I don't even exist as far as anybody else is concerned. My opinion doesn't matter. How many times have you heard that? Or how many times have you said it? What if we change that by living this verse out, exhorting one another daily? The word exhort there means to call near, to invite, to beseech, to comfort. The opposing synonyms would be yelling or threatening. So exhortation is about comforting someone, inviting them in. Let's look at that in 1 Thessalonians 4. Verse 18, Paul writes, "Therefore, comfort one another with these words." He had gone through various things leading up to this, not just in this chapter, in this whole letter. And he's not writing them just to write them. He's not writing them just to correct them. He's not writing them just to teach them. He's writing them to them, us by extension, so that we will comfort one another. Not accuse, not condemn, not belittle. That we'll comfort one another with these things. Because we can't change things in life, can we? Can we change what's going on in the world around us? Any point of anything that you want to consider in the world around us? We can't change any of that. What can we change? How we treat one another? And in this case, how we comfort one another? Look at chapter 5, verse 11. He says something very similar. "Therefore, comfort each other and edify one another, just as you are doing." He's doing the same thing, isn't he? He's encouraging them to encourage people by encouraging them. Comfort in this case means to edify, to embolden. Everyone needs encouragement. Because encouragement is a pure form of positive feedback, isn't it? We thrive on that humanly. It's encouraging for individuals to hear from people who recognize their contributions. It's encouraging for people to hear from someone when they think no one cares. When they've been in a hospital for an extended period of time, nobody can visit them, or they're home recuperating and they can't get out, or they're just being bombarded at work and they have no relief, or whatever it happens to be, for somebody to take the time and stop and say, in essence, "Just want to call you because I've been thinking about you. Want to make sure you're okay and that you know people are thinking of you." We're calmed and strengthened and edified when we're encouraged, aren't we? Lastly, let's turn to Romans 12. It is so easy for us to look at the world and be angry. There is so much anger out there right now. And when it drifts into the church, it hurts. That's not what we're to be. We're to be the opposite of what the world is. For all the hate, everybody that looks at us should see nothing but what we're talking about today. This kindness, this encouragement, this love, this exhortation in a positive way towards each other. They should see everything lacking in the world, not a reflection of it. The politics of the world, they're not going to end. And I'll give you a little insight here. It's just going to get worse. I don't want to be a part of that. I think God allows us to be exposed to it in the hopes that we'll get to a point where we just are so sick and tired of it that we want what He is offering. And so Romans 12 and verse 10, it says, "Be kindly affectioned one to another." If we're honest enough with ourselves, we don't need anybody to point out our weaknesses, our sins, our shortcomings. We know. What is not offered by the world is the love and support that we need, the encouragement that we need, the edification that we need. And so Paul's reminding us here to be kindly affectioned to one another with brotherly love. In honor, giving preference to one another. Because here's the thing about God's way of life. By serving and giving and helping someone else, we actually help ourselves. It doesn't take anything away from our calling. We're not any less of a person or a Christian. In fact, we're more. Because this is exactly what God is looking for. Because it's what He does for us. Life is challenging enough without making it more challenging for someone else. Our tongue speaks what's in our heart. So let's use our words wisely, and let's consider the power that we have in our tongue.